Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it is that time yet again for Tangential Banter. Welcome back. We're glad you could join us. My name is Ben Mell, and I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzanowski.
Hey, what's up, y'all? I have to admit that there won't be a soundboard, at least for the earlier part of the episode, because I currently have a cat on my... Oh, nope. Nope, he's just stepping off. All right, he's done. Never mind. I'm on my recliner. Or I was. Now I'm hopping up to my PC, and I'll bring the soundboard up and running and probably use it a grand total of twice.
I was really hoping that we were going to be treated to whatever sounds your cat made.
Oh, man, the amount of fur coming off this cat is insane.
It's actually that time of year for our fuzzy friends.
That it is.
As they shed their winter coat and transition to the summer.
You know, that's an interesting question. Do animals that live inside, like dogs or cats, because I live in an apartment, I don't let Milo out in the parking lot over the, you know, the winter or ever. You know, he's been cooped up inside. Do they get winter coats? Or, like, how is the winter versus summer coat thing triggered? Is it like a sunlight thing? Is it just like a you know how you have your circadian rhythm? Do they have like a seasonal rhythm? Or is it temperature dependent? Like, what triggers the change of coats? Because if it's temperature dependent, you know, they never get exposed to the colder air, or at least, you know, for long periods of time. So how would their body know?
I would anticipate it's tied to daylight, would be my guess. Like even that, though, even that could be fooled, though, right? Because they get a lot more artificial light. It's a good question.
It's true. Let's speculate wildly. But you know what? Why don't we... that wasn't what we were coming in with. Why don't you introduce the topic? And we can go to that one if we so choose later on.
Okay. I'm good with that. Well, the topic for today was actually introduced in our last episode. We said we would follow up in a future episode with this topic. So you already have the premise of the question if you've been listening along with us. But I'll repeat it again. And for those who didn't hear it, this will be your first chance to be introduced to it. So we just introduced it last episode and we'll dive into it now. And the thought behind this topic that originated it was, number one, what is it about sunrises and sunsets that humans find beautiful? And more generically speaking, what governs if humans find something to be beautiful or not? So last time we talked a fair amount about appearance in humans, like facial features and body types, whatever, that might be judged as beautiful. But this is a more generic question of beauty in nature, in art, whatever it might be, centered around this question of sunrises and sunsets. So that's the first part. The second part is, I mentioned that I could rationalize why we might find a sunrise beautiful, but that same rationale would lead me to believe that we would find sunsets to be ugly and scary and fearful. So for today's conversation, we'll explore this question and try to answer it in a satisfactory way.
How neat is that? That's pretty neat.
You can tell it's a sunset because of the way it is.
Yes.
So, Jack, any thoughts on this topic as we dive in here? I'll take that as a
I'm thinking it could be our, not everybody would agree with this, but it would be our appreciation of the creation around us that was imprinted in our hearts. Ooh. So we can kind of look around and like we've been designed to enjoy it as part of our stewardship over the earth. Evolutionarily, perhaps it is almost like a generational nostalgia, just how, like, when you see things that remind you of your childhood or some previous season of your life and you feel that sense of nostalgia, perhaps our brains have been trained or mutated or something so that there are certain things that trigger a maybe not the same, but a related thing. Like, you know, your ancestors, if they spent all their time outside, then when you see something like, you know, something outside in nature or a sunset or like a skyline, it makes you, or not the skyline of a city, but just, you know, sky, clouds and whatnot, it just feels right.
Mm.
And then when you're in like an industrial setting or some, you know, industrial park where it's just concrete buildings and, excuse me, not concrete buildings, concrete, comma, buildings, comma, chain link fence. There's just something like this dissonance in your brain. Like, this isn't what I'm used to. Even though you yourself might be used to it, there's something, it's almost like an instinct. Whereas an instinct is something, an inborn trait for you to do something or act in a certain way. This isn't one of those, but it's an inborn imagery that triggers, like, yes, this is where I'm supposed to be, feelings in your brain.
Mm. And building off your earlier point, it could be that we're inherently incapable of enjoying our creation as much as the creation that we find ourselves in.
Could be, yeah. But then, you know, that, what about art? Because that is our creation. Then again, a lot of art is meant to resemble or is modeled after nature. So maybe that's sort of tricking, you know, that part of our brain. But I would think too that because we ourselves are designed to be, you know, be creative and whatnot, that we would be given joy for our own creations too.
So yes, that's a good point. So going back to the question of sunrises and sunsets, the argument I put forward in our last episode was that I could rationalize why a sunset would be beautiful or a sunrise would be beautiful, because it is the herald of a coming day, right? It means we're transitioning from dark to light. It means that the fears of the unknown and darkness are dispelled as the light comes. There's less chance of things sneaking up on us and attacking us. So if you're talking about that evolutionary perspective of, you know, what could cause, what sort of utility could cause us to find a sunrise beautiful, I could find that argument plausible. But then that argument falls apart in the sunset perspective, because we find sunsets to be as beautiful as sunrise, but the reverse is happening. We're transitioning from the more safe, stable, defendable position of daylight into one where, you know, an attack could come from any direction at night because we can't see very well. We're much more defenseless. And so to me, it would seem that we would find sunsets to be scary, frightening, ugly, whatever. And yet we don't. And so over the years, since this question first came into my mind, I've tried to come up with alternative theories that would explain, from a utility perspective, what is it about, you know, if you're trying to argue from human evolution, what could possibly cause us to find them both equally beautiful? I haven't yet come up with that. From your initial position, I think it's easy that we have imprinted on our hearts a need and desire to appreciate beautiful things. And we know what beauty is, regardless of, or maybe independent of any utility that it has. But I can't come up with an argument from a human evolution perspective.
Well, I mean, your point about what's the word I'm looking for? Conundrum, maybe, of the sunset. Why do we find, like, you can come up with a logical explanation as to why we appreciate sunrises, which I would argue is certainly a plausible theory, because similarly, people You know, a fair bit of people are afraid of the dark. And I'd say the general population, if they don't have what would be considered as much of a phobia, they certainly are uncomfortable in the dark.
Absolutely.
And I would imagine it's due to the same, you know, that could be related. The same thing that causes people to be afraid of the dark, or at least uncomfortable with it, might be the very same, might be this, be a different side of the same coin of why we appreciate sunrises. Now, you're right about sunsets, but maybe it's because our brains, as far as the imagery goes, like we can, as far as the imagery goes, maybe our brains aren't sophisticated enough to tell the difference. Now, we can know logically if what we're looking at is a sunrise or a sunset, but the real fundamental base, subconscious trigger of see this image, produce this sensation, can't differentiate between the two. That could be possible too.
I feel like though, given where like the topic we were starting to talk about of how does an animal that sheds its coat know when to shed it? Is it light based, temperature based, whatever? I feel like we have enough other examples around us of creatures that are immensely in tune with their environment, that I would be surprised if we didn't have mechanisms to distinguish, biologically distinguish a sunrise from a sunset, right? Whether that's the chemicals that are in your body and brain when you're waking up versus when you're going to sleep, or like you said, circadian rhythms earlier. I don't know. It seems implausible to me that those would be indistinguishable from a biological perspective.
Sure, but I'm going off the assumption that what's triggering our seeing something and saying or feeling, oh wow, that's beautiful. I'm assuming that that process is purely based off of the signals coming out from our eyeballs. So there would be no circadian rhythm, there would be no other chemicals in the mix. It's just your brain interpreting the signals coming from your eyes, and the image that they're passing to your brain. So then the sunrise and the sunset are so similar that it can only produce, it can't divorce the two. It treats them both as the same thing, as
But
far as whether you consider it beautiful or not.
wouldn't you then end up with like a either a mixed message where it's frighteningly beautiful, or a coin flip where one day it's beautiful and the next day it's frightening? Like it seems weird that you would only get the switch for beautiful and never the one for scared, frightened, etc.
Well, you know, let's think evolutionarily here. Maybe there was a mutation that caused, let's say the maybe there maybe at some point, you know, humans couldn't care less one way or the other. This beauty phenomenon didn't exist. And then there was a mutation to where they thought, and then let me take a step back. I'm going to, for the sake of this or conversation or this point, I'm going to keep assuming that your brain can't. If it, I'm assuming a lot of things actually. One, that whether something is beautiful or not is purely based on the image and nothing else. And maybe it's over the generations, it's association with things, right? Dark is associated with can't see, we're more vulnerable. So be if we're general or genetically trained or conditioned to be afraid of it, so on and so forth. That's assumption number one. And assumption number two is that maybe at one point people weren't conditioned one way or the other. So maybe there was a mutation so that somebody was afraid of sunsets. Oh, and the other, sorry, third assumption is that your brain can't differentiate, as far as this beauty phenomenon goes, can't differentiate between sunrises and sunsets. It's a package deal, because they're so similar. So now let's assume that there's a mutation and people are all of a sudden, or that person is all of a sudden afraid of sunrises and sunsets. But then there's another mutation at some point where a person finds them both beautiful. Maybe, and maybe this could be a thought experiment, Mr. Ben, how would, since we are observing that people very generally find both of them beautiful, if the, all these series of assumptions are correct, which is, you know, likely not true, but just for
tenuous
fun.
Tenuous at best.
Yeah, tenuous, definitely. So, but for fun, what would the evolutionary benefits be of finding sunsets beautiful or both beautiful rather than ugly or vice versa? Because maybe if you find a sunrise, sunrises and sunsets scary, you might be better protected at night because you're afraid earlier, you're going to start preparing earlier and with more rigor. But if you're afraid of the sunrise, well, you're probably going to hide out and you're not going to be as productive for ensuring your survival during the day. Or at least in the morning, I should say.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how to respond to that. Because I agree with the position that you're making, but fundamentally, one, if you find a sunset beautiful, you're essentially, from the perspective that we're talking about, this argument, that is essentially saying that you are excited by or have some advantage offered by darkness. If you find a sunrise beautiful, you have some benefit or advantage offered by light, because they're both transitioning to the opposite. So I think the net gain, if you are, well, I'll say it this way. To me, it seems implausible if there was a mutation that you would be afraid of the sunrise, that you wouldn't also be, or that you wouldn't want sunset, right? Because it has to do with the amount of light in the sky. Like a vampire, for example, right? It would make sense that they would be afraid of the sunrise, but they would welcome the sunset because they want to be in darkness. For an animal that wants to be in light, it would make sense that they would welcome the sunrise and be afraid of the sunset. But here we have this paradox where we welcome both the sunrise and the sunset, seemingly equally.
Right.
But, I mean, the counterpoint to the argument you're making, I said vampire, but really you could look at just about any animal, right? Like nocturnal animals aren't staying up to welcome the sunrise because they find it beautiful, right? They are getting ready to return to their, or already returned to their den for the day. And vice versa, animals that are awake during the day aren't hanging out late into the night. So it seems like nature has already sorted itself into creatures that prefer either light or darkness. And so they would have opposing perspectives on whether sunrise and sunset are good or beautiful.
Right.
If we could ask them.
But we're not, remember, we're talking about beauty specifically, not the, which I think is one out of many factors that play into how imagery affects our emotions and behavior. Like a bat may not find sunrises or sunsets beautiful, but it knows that, hey, it's been really light out. Now I see the sun, that really bright light is on the horizon. Put those two things together, it's going to be dark soon. And that's all it knows. Or similarly, well, it has been dark for a while. Now I see a bright light on the horizon. It's going to be light soon. I just know that from experience. Or it could be like this entrained knowledge instinct, if you will, that they just realize that without even really thinking about it. But that's an independent factor of whether you find it beautiful. They could be related, but they could be separate too.
Right. So the argument I'm making, because I would tend to agree with you, I don't think a bat or other animals have a perception of beauty in the sense that we do. I think that's a higher order intellectual ability than what they have. But my point being is that if humanity has evolved from that level of mental capacity, then it would make sense for our appreciation of beauty to be tied to the pragmatic elements that we observed when we were lower order intellectual creatures. Not that we just somehow, without any connection to our environment or survivability or, you know, fitness for our environment, independently involved this appreciation for beauty that's not connected to a utility for survival. I'm arguing that's implausible.
Well, and I see your point, and I would definitely say it's plausible, and I would say I could certainly agree with it. I mean, we find nighttime a little scary, but when there's moonlight, we find it beautiful. Why? Because there's more light. It might be nighttime, but we can actually see around us now. So we would naturally develop an affinity for that. But what I'm saying is, in the case of sunrise and sunset, again, assuming that the beauty phenomenon is based off, the only thing it can really use to trigger a reaction is just the imagery that your eye is putting forward. In the case of the sunrise and sunset, because they are visually so stinking similar, your body can only have one reaction for both, where it can't see a sun on the horizon and just by the image alone know if it's a sunrise or sunset. So it kind of doesn't know, it either doesn't know how to react, and so it'll have no reaction at all, or it has to always be one or always be the other.
Actually, that would be an interesting study, to take photos of known, of sunrises and sunsets, where it's known if the sun was rising or setting, put them in front of people and see if there's any statistical ability for a person to determine if it's a sunrise or a sunset from just an image.
Ooh, that would be a good experiment. And again, what I'm positing is that they wouldn't really be able to tell. At least, unless there's some sort of, they know where it is and they know what direction the camera was pointing.
Right. And I'm saying like a blind study where all they're given is a picture. They don't know where the picture was taken. They don't know the time of year. They have no referential data.
Right. That'd be a great test.
I think it's likely that they wouldn't. But I would not be at all surprised if there was at least a statistically measurable ability for people to determine if it was a sunrise or a sunset without any other clues, only visual clues. Huh. Having taken pictures of enough of them, I feel like maybe there's subtleties that we couldn't describe, or like we couldn't tell you how we knew the difference.
Right.
But we might still know. That would be really interesting to know that.
It would be interesting. I'll have to think
about it. But going back to your argument is, okay, if we can't visually distinguish them enough, the switch is only basically light is changing, right? We don't know if it's getting brighter or darker. The only thing we know from a visual perspective is that we're changing from night to day.
Well, no, I don't think you even know it's not a matter of, the image can't tell you that. The image just tells you that that the sun is near the horizon. You don't know if it's getting darker or if it's getting brighter.
Sure. Okay. Either way, all the image tells you sun is near horizon. Why then should you develop any emotional response to it either way? Because you were saying, like, if a bat can't appreciate its beauty, all it knows is it's been night for a while, I mean, and the sun's on the horizon, that means it's going to be day, or it's been day for a while, sun's on the horizon, that means it's going to be night. Why, like, every day has one of those experiences, so why would that induce a bias to appreciate the fact that the sun is on the horizon at all, either fearful or beautiful? Right. It seems like you would just go, okay, that's what time it is. And it wouldn't induce appreciation or fear.
I would think that what you said earlier is the reason why, where evolutionarily, if the being that would benefit from some the implications of some image, like a moon in the sky that provides more light on the ground, the being who feels better, more motivated, less or more confident than the human or whatever, the specimen that doesn't, is going to take advantage of the benefits of that scenario more and therefore be more likely to survive and reproduce. So again, remember this, the concept of beauty then evolutionarily would have had been some guy randomly, his genes mutated, and all of a sudden he's the first guy who understood beauty or had a sense of beauty. So maybe he or she, you know, got a little, you know, saw the moonlight and got a little frisky and made a little bit more babies than your average person. And then they had the same gene and then they carried on. And, you know, that's how it spread.
Yeah, it's possible. If we find the moon lover gene, we will know we've cracked the code.
And then similarly, right, if somebody was just not just recognized maybe rationally or instinctively that, oh, it's dark out, I got to be careful. If they actually had a fear, I think that would reinforce their need to protect themselves. And so they'll be less exposed, less vulnerable to predators or accidents and so on and so forth. And then over the generations, the people with those genes slowly begin to outnumber those without it. And eventually the gene completely dominates.
Well, in your scenario, the person who is waiting until it's fully daylight and tucking themselves in while it's still light outside is going to have fewer opportunities to mate. So,
yeah, and less time to gather food.
Yep.
And so on and so forth. So that's why the person who finds sunrises beautiful may be more motivated to, oh, the sun is out. You know, the sun's rising. It's a beautiful day. I feel good. Yeah, let's go on a hike and get some food. Whereas a person who sees it say, no, I'm staying in, I'm hunkering down, I'm watching out. And then all of a sudden, a few hours later, hey, the guy who hunkered in is like, man, I'm hungry. And the guy who didn't hunker down is like, well, I'm not.
It still does seem, though, that, I'm trying to think of how to describe this, that you would be talking about different, like, because sunrise and sunset are at the marginal ends of how much light is in the sky, right? And so for the creature that's it's active earlier and later, it's more productive, it can reproduce more often, but those activities are not tied directly to sunrise or to sunset. And so if it's just tolerant of lower levels of light in the sky, and because it is, it reproduces more often, that wouldn't necessarily, like, if it's a daytime creature, it would still, should still feel the most comfortable and appreciate most full daylight. It's just more tolerant on the marginal sides of its acceptance zone. So it still seems like beauty would drive toward the middle of the day, even though it has more tolerance on the edges of the day. You see what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, maybe, though, it just ties into, you know, the whole middle of the day. Any one moment is hardly distinguishable from another. But then the event of a sunrise or sunset is such a unique image. You know, it's only there for a half hour, or maybe even less, of the day. Whereas the full day is around for so long that it just doesn't stick out as particularly beautiful. Not that it isn't beautiful, but it's not like, oh, look at that, Ben, look at that. What is it, Jack? It's 3 p.m. Isn't it beautiful? Oh, yeah. Ben, look, now it's 3:05. Isn't it beautiful?
So that actually leads to another element of this, or what could be at play, which is that sunrise and sunset tend to offer a far more rich color palette than midday. Midday is typical, you know, on an average day is very bright, There are harsh shadows, high contrast, and even as good as our eyes are, a lot of colors get washed out by how bright the sun is. Versus at sunrise and sunset, in the sky alone, you're seeing blue and purple and pink and yellow and orange and gold. And then you have much less contrast, so you can see all these subtle hues in different shades of green grass or whatever it might be. So if your hypothesis is correct that it's only a visual cue, then perhaps something about the, I'll say it this way, because there are so many colors in the palette, perhaps it's more stimulating, visually stimulating, from a sensory, physiology, neurology perspective, that there's just more activity in our brain processing all the different colors than there are at midday or in the dark. Hmm. And so that level of stimulation makes it more exciting and more beautiful.
Hmm. Which would seem to be a more of just like a one of those evolutionary also-rans where there was some mutation where for some reason more visual stimulation results in that feeling of I'm looking at something beautiful, but that may not really offer any like a particular benefit or disadvantage, but it's just sort of there, like it tagged along. It was some random mutation that had no effect on our survivability prolific. Is that the word I'm looking for? Where it's spread out a lot, right?
Proliferation.
Yeah, our proliferation. Thank you. And no effect on our proliferation. But it was still the mutation. So it's still there. And maybe it just never mutated away. When we talk about, and I think I brought this up in a previous episode, you know, a lot of people, when it comes to mutations, they only ever talk about the mutations that benefited us. You know, it's like, oh, then the birds evolved to fly. And then so on and so forth. But they never talk about, say, oh, yeah, there was a bird who mutated and all of a sudden he doesn't have any more feathers. So he's just a bird that can't really do anything that birds can. And the reason why they don't really talk about him, the reason why they don't really talk about him is because they don't stick around for too long. So they're not really in the fossil record. So we never really know about them. But then there's also those mutations that are just sort of random little things that don't really offer a benefit or a disadvantage. They're just sort of there. Like hair color. I mean, I think we've brought up a similar topic. I think we were talking about eye color before, where it's just like, you know, the mutation for different eye colors doesn't really affect our survival. So it just sort of happened and the genes spread. And it's just sort of one of these genetic also-rans or tag-alongs where it was a mutation, but it didn't really affect us one way or the other.
Do you think, like what we were talking about in our last episode of a preference for, from a beauty or attraction perspective, for a certain hair color or eye color, do you feel like that falls into that category as well?
Which category are we talking about? The beauty category, the genetic tag-alongs category?
Kind of both, where like... if you're someone who is attracted to a certain hair color, whether it's red or yellow or black or brown or whatever, it's a preference that doesn't really seem to have any impact on your suitability, survivability, proliferation, whatever. Would that fall into your also-ran category?
I think that would actually, maybe you're bringing up a interesting interplay between this beauty phenomenon where we see something, we see some visual trigger and all of a sudden our brains react in some interesting way. And you combine that, you combine that with this random mutation that doesn't by itself inherently offer any benefit. But maybe because it's interplaying with this beauty thing, that's how it spreads, because it's basically what's what I'm looking for, hitchhiking or getting a free ride off of this beauty phenomenon where blonde hair, for example, let's say that was I think that was a later mutation, but then for some reason, because of some other visual trigger in our brains, people found that more beautiful, almost coincidentally. And so more the person with blonde, people with blonde hair were getting picked first and making more babies. And that's how the blonde gene spread, because it just so happened to coincide with this beauty weird thing in our brains, even though being blonde doesn't actually, as you said, make you any more suitable as a mate.
Or maybe it's like a reverse preference thing where as a new hair or eye color mutation emerges, even if it's not preferred, it ends up, I feel like this argument's falling apart, but I was going to say, like,
that was quick.
If you were the let's say one of the members of the population with lower potential for breeding, and you're like, oh, nobody else prefers this category, I'm capable of like their potential mate for me because nobody else wants them, you could end up expanding the gene pool that way.
Hmm.
I don't know. That was kind of half-baked, but it's a possibility.
Yeah.
So another element tied into this conversation that you mentioned earlier and hadn't crossed my mind before, but I want to swing back to now, is the perception of nostalgia. Because I think the concept of beauty is tied to a current stimulus or stimuli, and we respond in a positive way to that stimulus or stimuli. Nostalgia is responding in a positive way to a past stimulus or stimuli. And
or the memory of, like, if you see something that reminds you of
right.
Your
past. Yeah. And it just has me wondering, like, I guess a personal observation is that it seems to me that most people are most nostalgic about things that occurred in their teenage years, I would say. So, for example, when you talk to an older person, often, and this isn't always true, but I would say often, they prefer music that was popular when they were growing up. So between like the ages of 10 and 20 in their teenage years. Or those will be the films that they prefer and the actors that they know and whatever else you want to add onto that list. But they feel the most nostalgic about that period of time in their life. And I wonder, as we're talking about what could be a pragmatic utilitarian origin for beauty, is what could be a pragmatic utilitarian origin for nostalgia that would make someone say, oh, those are the best days of my life, right? That period of time was, doesn't get better than that, you know? Or why every civilization since the beginning of time has had this phrase of the good old days, you know?
Thinking. So hold on, can you connect nostalgia? So I remember you said most people are nostalgic for the years when they were like teenagers and such. And what was your theory on why?
I didn't propose one. If I were to put a theory forward from a pragmatic survival perspective, I think I would be forced to say that our, like, physiologically, we are at our peak somewhere in that range. So we become capable of reproducing, we're healthy, we're, you know, we're growing, but we're mature. You know, we don't have significant health issues or concerns. Our mind is still somewhat flexible. if you wanted to sum it all up, you could say that's when we're in our prime, the prime of our life, kind of. And so maybe there's a biochemical trigger of some kind that locks in memories from that period, or that makes them most poignant. On the flip side, maybe a nurture versus nature perspective is that that's when the bulk of our neural pathways are being hardened. And so, you know, when we're really little, we don't have a lot of memories. Our brains were so pliable that there weren't, the pathways that were built were kind of constantly being rebuilt. It was just a, you know, like you always say, first 6 months of a baby's life is like being on acid.
Yes. Right. Learned it from a book. It was a book. It was a scientific book.
So maybe it's just that the pathway, the neural pathways that have been the most, or that were the most formative, that are kind of the most central to the way that we think, hardened during that stage of our lives. And so we've been impacted by and formed the most by things that happened during our teenage years.
I think as you were talking, that was the thought that came into my brain, that there's something biologically about that period of our lives that puts those memories in a certain special status, not because of there being any evolutionary benefit of doing so, but because while we're developing, like that stage of our development, you know, things kind of get weird during that time. Puberty's a weird time. It's almost like our, like humans' metamorphosis. So it would kind of make sense that the memories of that time would also be handled a little bit weirdly in our brains. And maybe that's all that's going on. It's a consequence of that period being biologically weird. So the memories from that time also are sort of in this weird state, and then get handled oddly for the rest of our lives.
What if it's like, just because of the high amount of hormones and stuff, as you're in that growth stage and going, like you said, going through puberty, if it actually like somehow chemically etches memories from that period or feelings from that period into your brain, because the chemical compounds are so strong that it's like, this isn't just permanent now.
Yeah, that could certainly be plausible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you just added an extra layer of uncertainty there. But it doesn't make it incorrect.
I guess, but it's like, I've been actively trying to not say things like, I'm trying to attempt to do this. Or,
yeah.
I'm thinking that this maybe will help. It's like, just say, I'm thinking this will help, or maybe this will help. If you're saying, I'm thinking this maybe will help, it's sort of like, I guess maybe for trying to convey, my thought is that this, how do I one word this? I'm not sure if this will help, but go ahead and try it. I think is another way of, a more concise way of saying, I'm thinking this may help. But just say this may help. You know, attacking on I think is redundant, because just by saying this may help obviously means that that's what you think. And then if you say I think this will help, that's enough to indicate, okay, that's not a guarantee. It's a maybe. So saying I think this may help is redundant.
It is, but in some cases, by adding that second conditional statement of uncertainty, you're reinforcing how uncertain you are. So if you say, I think this will help, that makes me think you're 80% confident. If you say, I think maybe this will help, that implies to me that you're somewhere between like 40 and 60% confident.
Sure.
So it may be redundant, but I do think it helps provide some level of additional clarity as far as how certain you actually are.
That's okay. And you know what? I have this, you know, this me actively trying not to be redundant like that. I'm particularly trying to hold to that when I'm saying like work emails or something where you do want to be concise for everybody's sake. So that's when I'm really trying, or like technical writing in general, that's when I'm really trying to adhere to that. Because saying in a technical communication, saying, I think this may help, or I think this maybe will help or something, or we attempted to try to do this. It's just like, it sounds clunky. There's too many words there. Just say, we attempted this. It didn't work. They'll get the point.
Yeah. And I think typically when we talk about taking out some of those qualifiers, it's more around becoming assertive, confident, not discounting your opinions, right? Because sometimes we'll do that to soften the way that it sounds and give people a possible out, whatever.
Be non-committal in general, yeah.
I do think there are cases where that's true and we should eliminate the unnecessary qualifiers to strengthen the statement that's made. And we can do that too much because we're trying to ease tensions or avoid conflict or whatever. But I do think there are cases where it's still appropriate because, again, it does lend itself to understanding the certainty of the situation or emphasizing the fact that it's an uncertain situation. But it's just become such a common part of our lexicon that I think often we don't derive any additional value from those words.
I would say, yeah, I would agree with you. I think it's not a lexicon, but just, you know, a language thing that's used much more often than it ought to be.
Sure.
It's overused. It's not that it doesn't have its place, because I agree with you. If you really want to emphasize, I really don't know, or you know, the really drive forward how uncertain something is, then sure. But I think a lot of times people are just repeating themselves needlessly. Now, I do have a question.
Okay.
If in English, a double negative is a positive, I didn't not do it, does that mean a double uncertainty means that you're certain? Should we start?
Oh, man.
Should we, like, I know it doesn't, right? If you say, I think maybe this will help, or I'm certain that this maybe will help, that's not me, like, that's a double uncertainty. You're saying you're uncertain and you're saying it maybe will help. Those two things, like if you just said, I'm uncertain this will help, or maybe this will help, both of those imply an uncertainty. So if you say, I'm uncertain that maybe this will help, does that mean, oh, 100% boy, this is going to work? Like, should we start? Now it obviously doesn't. Nobody who speaks English, unless they're learning it and aren't really sure of the language, is going to think that you're talking with confidence. But maybe, Ben, you and I could be trendsetters.
Ooh, wow. So if I say, I think maybe it's going to work, or maybe that could work, is as airtight as it gets.
Yes, because saying that could work is meaningfully the same as saying maybe that could work.
Okay, but problematic now is we've established certainty. But is it affirmative certainty or is it negation certainty?
How do you mean?
Okay. If I say maybe that could work, we established I did not do it means if it's a double negative that I did it, right? Double uncertainty, maybe that could work. Does that mean it will work or it absolutely will work or it absolutely won't work?
In the sentence that you provided, I would say that it's certain that it will. Now, if you said maybe that could not work, would be in our trend setting, would mean it for sure won't happen. It sure is not going to work.
So what if I say then, I'm not sure that won't work, double negative and double uncertainty.
I'm not sure. So that's,
or I'm not sure. I'm not sure that couldn't work.
Ooh, okay. I'm not sure, that's a certainty, that couldn't work. Okay, let's think about this. I'm not sure, there's your uncertainty. Could not. Oh, no. But then the could is the other uncertainty. And then what are you now? Double uncertainty. Okay, so you're certain. What are you certain of happening? That not working. So I'm unsure that couldn't work would mean that you're absolutely certain it's not going to work.
No, but you got the double negative, so you're absolutely certain it will work.
No, you're not double. It's not double negative because saying, because what you just said, I'm not certain that couldn't work, is the same as saying I'm uncertain that couldn't work, which we've already established is a double uncertainty on a single negative.
Okay, so we'll say I'm not uncertain that couldn't work.
I'm not uncertain. See, now that could, so I'm not uncertain that couldn't work. So now you're saying, see, the not does it, the not, the first not, I'm not uncertain, that doesn't apply to the verb. That's not applying to the action. That's applying to the certainty level.
Okay, so fabricate any scenario you want with a double uncertainty and a double negative.
So, okay.
Are we saying you're absolutely certain that will happen?
Double negative and a double uncertainty. Yes. So I didn't not go to the store today. So that means I did go to the store. I'm not, so if you just said, I'm uncertain that maybe I didn't not go to the store today. I got to say that with a straight face. I'm uncertain that maybe I didn't not go to the store today. Means that I for sure, based on our trend setting of double uncertainties, means that I for sure put your money on it, bet your bottom dollar that I went to the store today.
I mean, if you put me in a court of law and I was cross-examining a witness and that was their answer, I said, did you go to the store today? And they said, I'm unsure that I did not go to the store today. I would bet my bottom dollar that they went to the store today.
I'm uncertain that I did not go to the store. But remember, there's only one uncertainty in there. Now let's mix up the uncertainties with the actions. I'm uncertain that I didn't maybe not go to the store today.
Okay, I'm setting that question aside now for this hypothetical. If you were in court on the stand and you were asked to give an answer, what if you just spouted out verbal nonsense like that? It's not that you didn't answer the question, right? It's just like they don't know what your answer means.
that's how you get them, man.
Yeah, this is how I talk.
I would imagine, though, if you, like, realistically, if you did that, like, it would probably wouldn't take too many exchanges for the judge to hold you in contempt of court. Because they'll start asking you yes or no questions.
Just commit to the bit, then.
Hey, Ben, mate, that's what trendsetting costs sometimes. We have to be imprisoned for our beliefs.
Also, I'm not sure, I'd be curious. If we have any lawyer friends listening, if a witness is being questioned, can they legally be constrained to provide only a yes or no answer? Even if the question's framed as a yes or no, do they still have the freedom to answer however they would please? Or can a judge compel them to answer with a simple yes or no?
Based on my high levels of experience watching crime shows on the TV, I would think that yes, you as a witness or being called up to the stand can be, what's the word you use? Not coerced.
Compelled.
Compelled. Can be compelled to answer questions yes or no.
Okay, but in that scenario, I think it would be dependent on the lawyer questioning you to be paying enough attention to ask the judge to compel you to do so. In which case, you're really in a battle of wits against the lawyer questioning you. If they're smart enough to frame the questions as yes or no, and then get the judge to compel you, then you're stuck. But if you can just word salad your way around the equation and they don't think it through enough to frame it or to compel you to say yes or no, then you're fine.
Word salad. I like that. We'll be the word like, salad ears.
Yeah. Like, where were you this afternoon? I am not sure that I may have been at the grocery store.
It's just like when people use like double negatives to try to weasel their way out, or like rather than answering an affirmation of a question, like, what did you do today? I went to the store today. I'm trying to think of an example of what I'm talking about. So there's the affirmation of the positive, but then there's the denying of the negative, and those are two different things.
Sure. Yeah.
Especially
in legal principles.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head. Like, did the coin land heads or tails? You know, it landed tails would be the affirmation of the positive. Okay. So then did the coin land heads or tails? It didn't not land, tails. Land on heads. Oh, wait, hold on. It didn't land. Oh, excuse me. I guess it wouldn't be denying of the negative, right? Saying it landed on tails means that it landed on tails. It didn't land on head, right? Now, if you said, you know, what side did the coin land on? Well, it didn't land on heads. Oh, so it landed on tails? Well, no, we never flipped the coin.
Right.
So that's
or it landed on its edge somehow.
Yeah, that's the denying of the negative, because if you affirm the positive, in this case, a simple coin flip, if you affirm that it landed on a particular side, heads or tails, you're confirming that the coin flipped and it landed on the given side. If you're just denying that it, or
it's denying or negating. I think
So if you deny that it landed on the other side, if you deny that it landed on heads, now people are going to assume, oh, so it landed on tails, but there's yes. the unspoken condition that the coin was never flipped. And that's the nuance. And when you get more complicated questions, those nuances can grow and grow and grow. So when people negate or deny the negative, they want you to think that they're affirming the positive when they aren't actually doing so.
I wouldn't say that's always the case, but in the scenario that we're talking about, a wily witness or a lawyer or whatever could certainly use that to great effect, right? Because they could deny the negative, and to a jury, it would sound like they affirmed the positive when they didn't actually. Like, you could skirt your way around a whole bunch of things without perjuring yourself in a way that would lead a jury to believe one thing that is not at all what you said.
Right. And I would think there's a lot of weaselly lawyers out there, coaching their witnesses to do just that.
To say that they're not unsure if they were maybe at the grocery store.
Right. In my view, and again, I'm not a lawyer, I would think, like, as a layperson, as far as the legal system goes, I would view a good lawyer as somebody who doesn't have to hide the truth, but convinces the jury or the judge, depending on what sort of case it is, that my defendant is in the right, despite the truth, but the truth he may think, you know, he should be in trouble, but actually, if you think about it this way, he shouldn't be. And then convincing the judge or the jury that the lawyer's right. A bad lawyer is somebody who tries to trick the judge or the jury into thinking that something that didn't happen did happen, or vice versa. Because then they're trying to hide the truth rather than convince them that the truth was that the defendant was justified in the truth, or that their client, I should say.
Right. And I think that's an important point, that so our system depends, or I shouldn't say depends, but is predicated on the assumption that both sides are trying to win, which in some scenarios is okay, because there is a middle ground. Like, if you're settling a divorce or something, right, there's probably blame on both sides, and settling, you know, dividing assets, whatever. But in a case of like, well, did they murder the person or not? Only one of those scenarios can be true. And so inherently, one side is arguing for something that is not true, right? Like, either they're the prosecution is arguing, is making false accusations, or the defense is mounting, you know, is trying to exonerate someone who's guilty.
Right. Now, I do want to sneak in. There is also the nuance of the lawyer, in this case, the defendant's lawyer, the accused murderer, might not try to downplay, okay, this person, my defendant, you know, rather than trying to argue my defendant didn't kill the victim, but arguing he did kill him, but it was in self-defense, or he may have killed him, but the state gathered evidence illegally. So he can't hold that against him. But so, simplification, yes. I wanted to get that out there. But as far as thinking about it more simply, like one side is arguing for something that's false, the other side is arguing for something that's true. Yes, that setup, continue.
So my point being is that I think often we see, and I don't know the extent to which this is prevalent, but I believe from, you know, I watch YouTube videos of lawyers talking about analysis of different cases and things like that periodically. And from what I take to be the general consensus, most lawyers believe that their obligation is to their client and to present the best possible case for their client, which in some cases is in defense of a lie or in, what's the word I'm looking for? Prosecuting a lie, essentially. And so my argument would be is that, well, a lawyer's actual obligation is to the truth, which isn't to say that they shouldn't mount a defense for their client, but in the example that you gave, okay, he did murder the person. We're not arguing that fact, but it was in self-defense, right? That is, if that is the truth, then there should be a reduced sentence. So I think there's an element of our criminal justice system, or even our civil law system, that is out of whack because we promote this elevation of obligation to the client above everything else.
Right.
Because we want people to have due process and to be well defended, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which I think to some in some regards, that's healthy. We want there to be a burden of proof that we can say, yes, we've shown beyond a reasonable doubt that this person did what they're accused of doing. But on the flip side, if a lawyer, you know, has very clear evidence this person did do it, and they're trying to get them out on a technicality or whatever else, it's like, I believe they have an obligation to the truth in addition to their obligation to the client that should prevent them from, or someone with scruples from trying to be that I didn't not do it kind of a thing. Right.
I would counter that by, you know, I think a good defense lawyer, again, let's go with the murder case. It's not the defense lawyer's responsibility. It's not his role to ensure that a murderer is put away. His job is to make sure that if the prosecution wants to lock somebody away for the rest of his life or for their life for killing someone, the state better damn well have their ducks in a row if they're going to go through with that. So his job is to make the state or the prosecution work as hard as possible to I would say this is the ideal job of a defense attorney. Now, a lot of attorneys would, you know, resort to dirty tricks to do this, and that's where they're subverting their role. Their role, although it's not to put a murderer away, their role isn't to let a murderer go free either. It's not like let the murderer go free at all costs. It's just, hey, if the state's going to put this guy away, they better damn well do their due diligence. And I'm going to make them do that.
On the flip side of that, suppose you're the defense attorney your client has told you that they murdered this person. Every shred of evidence points to them being guilty. What, even though your role is to ensure that the state puts up a valid case, why would you put forth the effort to try to get this person out of facing justice for that crime?
Don't view it as you're trying to get the murderer off. View it as if your client told you
that they did it, are you not trying to get them out?
No, you're not. You're trying to make sure that the prosecution in their accusing this guy and presenting evidence is doing their due diligence. So when they present, look at the handgun, it has fingerprints on. So how'd you collect the fingerprints? Where'd you get the gun? Was there any of your office has a history of contaminating evidence or planting evidence? Like, how do we know that that wasn't what was done? Because, yeah, the guy may have murdered the guy, but that doesn't mean that the state is clean, that their hands are clean either. They could be framing the
guy. Just because their hands, let's assume that their hands aren't clean. That doesn't mean that your client isn't guilty of murder and shouldn't face justice for that just because of a technicality.
Sure. And I would think that a lot of defense attorneys do have this conundrum, this ethical dilemma that they have to push through. But at the same time, remember, a lawyer is there, or the system of attorneys in broad terms. What if I were a lawyer, because I've thought about this before, you know, would I be able to do this very sort of thing? Defend a guy who's completely unapologetic for a murder or a rape or something, and would I be able to defend him? What I would have to remind myself of is, if we don't hold the state accountable for their accusations and trying of people, that is a house of cards that can come down very quickly. So if you start making concessions as an attorney, or just as a society, that, oh, this guy's a murderer, you know, all the evidence pointed, we don't have to really give him due process, right? Well, like, I, as the attorney, am going to sabotage the case, make sure this guy goes away. Well, that can quickly turn into, oh, this guy started speaking out against the state, I'm going to start, you know, he deserves to go to jail. And all of a sudden, the state can oppress people through the court system because due diligence isn't there. As soon as you start making concessions as to what sort of criminals get the fullest extent of defense, the state will start eating and eroding that away to where only the people that they want to be defended get good defense.
Which you could actually argue is already the case, because often those who need defending can't afford it. And so they get a state-provided attorney who's doing the work pro bono and has a bajillion cases, doesn't have the time to dedicate to it, can't really mount a thorough defense, doesn't exhaust all the options available to them. Right. So people end up incarcerated by default because they're poorly represented, whether or not they were actually guilty of the crime they're accused of.
But and that's an example of what I'm talking about. That what you just explained is the consequence of the phenomenon of the people who, if we don't have adequate, like solid, competent representation, even for the most heinous of crimes and heinous of criminals, as soon as you start making concessions, then the concessions are going to start encroaching into areas where you don't think those concessions should be made, but you're going to be powerless to do anything about it.
So I would say it this way. In an ideal scenario where there's still crime, right? So not fully ideal, but in an ideal criminal justice system, what you're arguing is that everyone needs to be represented as perfectly as possible, defended as well as possible, so that we protect the freedoms of those who are innocent, and right, they don't end up being prosecuted for things that they didn't do, right? It's the Blackstone ratio, I think, is the name for it, that he would rather basically 10 guilty go free than one innocent be incarcerated, essentially. That's the greater good premise behind that. But if we had the ability to do it, wouldn't it be better if we could provide the and again, I'm not saying this is possible, but provide the full and enthusiastic defense for those whose guilt is uncertain and not put that effort in for those whose guilt is certain.
Yes, and I agree with you that it's not possible because, and it shouldn't be how we do things because the judge and the jury are no longer the judge and the jury. The defense attorney is the judge and jury. He's making the call. I get to decide whether this guy gets a defense or not. I get to decide whether I present this guy's case or not. And if it's just the prosecution against a lawyer who's deliberately sitting on the benches saying, yeah, he's guilty of sin, lock him away, what do you think the jury's going to do?
But if you're my defense attorney and I tell you that I murdered the guy, that's not you deciding that I'm guilty. That's me admitting that I'm guilty. Like, that's
the reality, right? But what happens when I see Joe Schmo? Oh, Joe Schmo used to bully me in class. Then we go to courtroom. And then the prosecution argues, and that's why we think Joe Schmo is guilty. And Joe says, you're not, okay, Jack, get up there and defend me because you know I didn't do it. Yeah, you're right, Joe. I didn't know that. And then I, yeah, lock him away. He's as guilty as sin.
Yeah, that's where I'm saying that dual obligation to both your client and the truth, right? In that scenario, like you bully me in high school, if I'm not representing you well, I'm not fulfilling my obligation to you or to the truth, right? I'm not certainly if this was used without prudence, there wouldn't be you wouldn't have any trust in the attorney, right? Vindictively, I guess you could say.
When I have trust in the attorney?
Well, I'll say it this way. In a normal scenario, if you were my attorney and I had bullied you in high school, I would either find a new attorney or ask to be assigned one, explaining the circumstances and that you likely couldn't be impartial in defending my case, right?
Okay.
But so there are still avenues to obtain a rigorous defense in that scenario.
Yeah, but what if you hire my firm? They don't know that I know you. They assign me to the case. And you're like, hey, look, somebody I know. I'm going to be like, oh, great. Now I'm a shoo-in. You don't really remember or you maybe don't think that, you know, maybe you think that we're friends because we are familiar with one another. And I just, you know, play the part so I can get my revenge all the while acting buddy-buddy with you until the courtroom. You know, there's a number of scenarios. And the point I want to make before I forget to make it, my summary of my thoughts on this topic is that you may not you, but society may not realize it, but society really wants as ravenous a defense attorney industry as they can get, because they are the only line of defense between the state being able to lock away anybody whom they so choose and the people actually retaining power in the courtroom. But that means that you're going to have defense attorneys giving ravenous defenses of people who absolutely deserve jail or worse. That's the cost, that they're not the exception. Nobody's the exception. That's the point. Because as soon as you start making exceptions, it's not going to take long for that to erode away, and now all of a sudden the greater population can get picked off by the state as the state wills. You don't want to have any cracks in that dam.
So what if you just lowered the consequences? We don't incarcerate people anymore. Then the stakes are much lower.
That's true. Then you don't need a defense attorneys. But then why do we have a justice system in the first place?
Ooh, that's a fundamentally deep question. Sounds like a topic for another podcast.
Indeed. Yeah, what time are we at?
I think we're closing in on an hour 20 here.
Oh, wow.
15 or 20. In the words of Kevin Malone from The Office,
Why have justice system when no justice system do trick?
Yes, I remember that scene very well. Word for word.
Yeah.
Great, great absolutely. Impression, Ben.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, I think we have run that one from stem to stern. So unless you have any final thoughts to add, I propose we head on into harbor for this episode.
Oh, there's another idiom.
Yeah, I didn't mix metaphors, though. Kept it consistent.
Hmm. Oh, real quick, speaking of idioms. So I was reflecting back on where I heard the phrase, don't count your eggs before they're in the pudding. And I think it's from Master and Commander, which takes place in it's a story about like a Napoleonic Wars era British warship. So it might be an older English term or idiom, sorry.
Interesting.
Now I'm going to go watch.
Good film as well.
Oh, it's a great movie.
Okay. So one final logistics element. I did in our last episode, I published a link in the episode description as well as in the post sharing the link to the episode, the sign up to be a guest on the podcast. We've already had at least one person use it. And so again, if you're listening, you want to contribute, you'd like to join us for a topic, you have one in mind, or you just want to participate in some way, do use the link. I'll make that a standard practice now to put the link to that sign up in the episode description, as well as the post with the episode in it. So feel free to sign up there. We'll check it periodically. And once we got some names in there, we'll begin to schedule some guest appearances. So with all that in mind, thanks again for listening, and we will catch you next time. Till then, take care.
Cats on the flippity flop.
Yeah.